this week on COVID, race, and democracy.
Rule First Local 36, we've taken care of our business at the LA County Labor Federation. This body needs to take care of its business and make sure that these three people are excommunicado in this building.
In Los Angeles, protesters demanded justice and accountability from city leadership over racist and inflammatory anti-black and anti-indigenous remarks in a leaked private meeting.
When all this is at a point of collapse, the workers are then blamed for asking that they can have a living wage. And instead of that, they've been offered privatization.
Thousands of South African dockers hit the picket lines in a national strike against a state-owned corporation that runs the nation's ports.
Billions of dollars that could be spent on healthcare, schools, and infrastructure is being thrown away to the war machine. This has no benefit to the working class.
And as part of a national week of action, 60 rallies are being held in the U.S. and around the world against the U.S. and NATO's growing war in Ukraine. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates around the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. In Los Angeles, labor leaders Ron Herrera and City Council President Nuri Martinez have resigned after protesters demanded justice and accountability for Martinez's racist and inflammatory anti-black and anti-indigenous remarks in a leaked private meeting. Herrera, Martinez, Councilman Kevin De Leon, and Councilman Gil Cedillo were meeting to promote Latino political power by gerrymandering the city's political districts to the exclusion of black political power. De Leon and Cedillo have not yet resigned. WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke interviewed Los Angeles Roofers Local 36 manager Cliff Smith about the scandal, the role of union leadership, and the housing crisis in Los Angeles.
This is Thomas O'Rourke for Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy program. I have on the phone Cliff Smith of the Roofers and Waterproofers Union of Los Angeles.
We cover four counties of Los Angeles, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and Ventura.
Mr. Smith, please explain to our viewers your take on the recently made public and now scandalous phone call or calls between Los Angeles Council Chair Nuri Martinez and several other council members, along with a union leader from the L.A. Labor Council.
Well, there's a lot of elements to it. You know, most obviously is that this was a private secret meeting between the president of the Los Angeles County Federation of Labor, AFL-CIO, Ron Herrera, with three council members, including the council president, and apparently the purpose of their meeting was to discuss the redistricting of the council boundaries in Los Angeles, and that prompted other discussions of a council member that was soon to be removed at the time of this recording after he had been indicted, and the council president's anticipation that that would provoke some outcry as he was a African-American elected representative, and these four people in this meeting are all Chicano or Latino officials, and then, you know, the consequences that they anticipated and, you know, how they would address that. And, you know, we're all familiar with the verbiage that was used.
How was this call leaked, and who do you think did it, and for what reasons?
Well, that's the, you know, the kind of the question of the day underneath all of the scandal, you know, directly involving these council representatives. So the County Labor Federation president, Ron Herrera, he had resigned by the end of Monday. The council president, Nuri Martinez, stepped down as president on Monday, and then by Wednesday, she resigned from the council altogether. The other two council members, Gil Cedillo and Kevin De Leon, are arrogantly refusing to resign from the council, and council business has been ground to a halt by protests. So, you know, as far as how did this meeting get recorded, you know, that's the real mystery underneath it, because the meeting took place at the inner offices of the County Federation of Labor. It was in October of last year, you know, at which time a lot of business was being conducted remotely, virtually, you know, due to the pandemic. So who had access to those offices? Not a whole lot of people. You know, we can only speculate as to, you know, what was the direct motive, or who, you know, would have had access, or what level of technology was used. So, you know, it's anybody's guess, really. As a union representative, we have to be honest and self-critical about the contradictions inside of our own movement. You know, we were elected and empowered to represent, number one, our individual union local members that elected us into these positions to represent them as a totality. And, you know, my local union, there are workers that come from Mexico or are second generation or have roots in Oaxaca or are African American, and, you know, I have an obligation to represent all of them collectively. So, you know, the exposure in these recordings that there's preference being given to a certain demographic or, you know, nationality versus others, and the disparaging and offensive and racist comments, you know, that affects our relations in the community, and it affects our relations within our local unions, and it certainly undermines our integrity. You know, there's just no place for it. Solidarity is our greatest strength as the labor movement, and this is the absolute opposite of solidarity.
How many of these politicians, these Democratic Party politicians, were actually endorsed by L.A. labor officials or the council in general? And if so, how was that endorsement arrived at?
Well, Gil Cedillo and Kevin De Leon have long histories of being elected officials at different levels, at local and state level. De Leon served in the state Senate and Assembly. Cedillo, I believe, was an assemblyman for, you know, several terms before becoming a councilman. Nuri Martinez was an elected official in, you know, one city before she came, and then in the school district, and then in the city council, and then president. So the County Labor Federation, you know, has a long relationship with each of these individuals in various offices and positions in different levels. So it's not surprising that they're familiar with each other, but, you know, labor policy or public city municipal policy, that this has to be done transparently, you know, in front of the community or in front of the members of the labor movement.
Do you think this will prompt unions in Southern California to think twice about endorsing Democrats in future elections?
I don't expect that at all, even though it ought to. You know, okay. If there's any lesson that we take from this, well, certainly there's more than one lesson that we need to take from it, but among them, to your point, is that this exposes the very incestuous relationship between the labor leadership and the Democratic Party. And, you know, one thing that emerged from this that I think a lot of people weren't aware of is that, for instance, Ron Herrera, the Labor Federation president's chief of staff, Justin Wesson, is the son of Herb Wesson, who is the previous president of the city council. And, you know, then Justin was hired to be the chief of staff at the Labor Federation. And then Justin Wesson's wife is the chief of staff of Nuri Martinez, the disgraced now resigned council president that replaced Justin Wesson's father as council president. So, you know, and to go even further, Ron Herrera, predecessor as president of the County Labor Federation, Rusty Hicks, is now head of the California State Democratic Party. So, you know, there's kind of no end to the inner relationships between these elected Democratic Party career politicians and the top ranks of labor leadership. And, you know, certainly that has done no service to the rank and file, to the labor movement. And, you know, we need to be talking about building a workers' party. We need to be talking about challenging Democratic Party elected officials, you know, everywhere that we can.
What, in your opinion, are some of the greatest challenges your union members and residents of Los Angeles and Southern California are facing? And speak, if you could, about the housing crisis in Southern California.
The members of our unions in Los Angeles, as well as the greater community, like the rest of the country, and really we see the world, are facing intense economic crisis of rising prices and inflation, super profits in fuel, the cost of food, and then, as you're, you know, emphasizing, rising housing costs across all of California and, you know, many cities nationally, where the areas that we work in, we can't afford to live. Representing building and construction trades union, you know, my members are working on projects and developments all throughout Los Angeles, developing the city. They're going to be bringing the Olympics here. They're going to be bringing the World Cup. And, you know, building museums and entertainment centers and stadiums and hotels for somebody to come and enjoy. But our members, you know, are not able to afford to live in, you know, the neighborhoods that we're redeveloping. As far as the political obstacles, again, is that our leadership, you know, across the board at the top levels of these, you know, unions, they do not show the willingness to be able to stand up to these capitalist powers, the developers, their financiers, the banks, the Democratic Party political forces that, you know, represent those capitalist interests, and break from them and challenge them and demand that, it, you know, it, the solution to rising prices should not be lowering wages and creating more unemployment, which is what they're trying to do by increasing interest rates. It should be by taxing rich corporations, wealthy people, putting caps on profits, nationalizing industries that impact the entire communities. You know, there's different ways that the government could be approaching the economic problems other than trying to, you know, resolve them on the backs of working people. We see unions, for instance, in France right now that they're shutting down the petroleum industry, they're shutting down the transportation industry because the government there is threatening to increase their retirement age or, you know, drive down their wages. So they have militant unions that are willing to go out into the streets and shut down the economy and use that leverage to be able to improve their conditions. In the United States, we don't see that type of leadership.
Describe, if you would, what you observe of the systemic corruption of the Democratic Party and office holders in their support for gentrification, for privatization, and seemingly their lack of ability to resolve this housing crisis. And I say that while keeping in mind pictures I've seen on television of large swaths of parts of Los Angeles, seemingly tent cities. It's no longer just Skid Row downtown. It seems there are people living in tents around the county. Whose fault is this, and what do you caution us in thinking about how the police play a role in resolving or addressing this problem?
Well, the Democratic Party, you know, that runs the politics of the city, they're indebted to their financial backers, which is the development forces, the landlords, the property owning classes. And so, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily be corruption, you know, that there's behind closed door meetings all the time. A lot of this is done right out in the open. You know, they pass laws and develop policy that is in the interests of their classes, the people that finance their campaigns, and, you know, whether it's done surreptitiously or whether it's done out in the open, you know, it's the same interests. Nancy Pelosi has stated flatly that the Democratic Party is a capitalist party, and, you know, it's pretty apparent where her personal family financial interests lay. They're not with working class people. They're not with the people that, you know, live in our communities that are make up the membership of my union or the vast majority of the cities across the state or across the country. So, you know, we can't expect the Democratic Party to be concerned with solving our problems.
That was Los Angeles Roofers Local 36 business manager Cliff Smith speaking with WPFW's Thomas O'Rourke.
We are the dogs of Tijuana, filled with garbage and stones, in the streets and in the fields, cursed and crushed beneath the wheels, but together we are strong. Our songs echo in the darkness, down the Maquiladora's halls, where Brother Solomon was tortured, but one tree in the orchard cast a shadow on the wall. Is hard and long, but the dogs are coming home. We are the dogs of Tijuana, left for dead in the ravine, in the arroyos, in the valleys, the sewers and the alleys. We shiver and we dream, so don't stop to ask directions. Think you lost your way? The wrath of the lion is the wisdom of God, and every dog has its day.
That was The Dogs of Tijuana by Tom Morello. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. Last week, thousands of South African dock workers hit the picket lines in a national strike against the majority state-owned Transnet Corporation, which runs the ports. They are demanding major wage increases and also fighting privatization and contract labor. We hear from J.V. Duby, General Secretary of the Revolutionary Transport Union of South Africa, and Dave Hempson, an organizer in the 70s of Durban Dockers and one of the founders of COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions.
The offer which they've said is a final offer is around 3%, which was going to be paid as from January, or in fact in three installments, which was on January 2023, February 2023, and also March 2023. All the unions have just agreed that 3% on the basis of the circumstance of the economy in South Africa, the 3% is not enough. In fact, it is below the CPI, a consumer price index, which is currently at 4.5%. So if you give 3%, that's next to nothing on the basis of the high rise of inflation in South Africa, where, you know, economically we're not doing very well. We have seen from, you know, last year around 1.5 million, you know, from the COVID, which was COVID-19 started in 2019 up to 2021. We have lost almost around 1.5 million workers in South Africa. So things as we stand right now are not so good in South Africa, economical wise. And politically, there's a lot of things that is happening. Things, if you've been just following the news, you know, the president of the country, which is also the president of the ANC, Cyril Ramaphosa, was booed on May last year during May Day. And also, onto the conference of COSATU, it was quite an embarrassment. The president was booed and he did not address the May Day. The person who's coming from the union, who's got almost next to 25 years of experience, was currently the leader in ANC. And in terms of the portfolio, is leading the portfolio of energy. He was booed and in fact, he was refused to address the conference of COSATU. For the first time in history, the COSATU has not given a resolution to support the ANC onto the election. This is going to be a worst thing in South Africa if indeed COSATU, as they've pronounced, they are not going to support the ANC into the election. Mind you, the ANC will be having its conference on December this year. On 2024, the ANC will be, there will be a national government elections. And currently, ANC is around 50% or 51%. So if indeed COSATU does not, which is the largest federation in South Africa with plus minus 1.8 million workers, if indeed it does not support the ANC, ANC will be losing the election dismally. ANC currently is just standing on a very slippery position. Now, with COSATU pronouncing that it won't be supporting the ANC, one is expecting the disaster in 2024. So things are not bad, are so bad in South Africa politically. And also, there's been a lot of strikes. You know, as now we are just having this strike of Transnet, there's been a lot of strikes. In fact, from July up until today, in South Africa, it was like a strike season. Most companies have settled at around 7%, 7.5%. Then you can imagine, therefore, if Transnet, which got actually almost 1.5 trillion assets in South Africa, if it's going to have this sort of strike, it is going to be very disastrous.
We've got the marvelous example of the ILWU, which even many years back had achieved something like $45 an hour in terms of its, and negotiation. Our workers are lucky if we can even get 45 rand, and remember the rand is about a 20th of a dollar an hour. And this is what we're struggling for. We have, you know, dirt cheap conditions, total mismanagement, so that the railway system has been collapsing. Transnet, as you'll see from that link I've sent over, has been the main basis in which corruption, the distribution of state funds, all the funds which should be coming to the workers have actually gone to the Guptas, to secret connections with Indian businessmen, to people who are connected in dubious ways with the ANC, who are funding it and so forth. And then when all this is at a point of collapse, the workers are then blamed for asking that they can have a living wage. And instead of that, they've been offered privatization. Now, privatization is argued that this is a form by which we can have rational system. At least profit is some way of judging whether a thing is working or not. But what we're seeing in privatization, first of all, we've never seen this in an efficient, rational privatization anywhere. And what we're seeing in South Africa is privatization to cronies to build an oligarch system in South Africa, which has already been started, and we don't want it seeing developed any further. In other words, all the pals of President Ramaphosa will be in the first in line, in the queue, I think is the way JV put it, to get the cash. And so they will be getting the plum jobs, the same apparatus, the same equipment, and now they'll be able to try and beat the workers back and back again to force new labor conditions, which will bring our workers into new slave, semi-slave conditions, rushing to get a job every morning, as what we fought against in the 1960s and beyond. We were in that fight to get the workers away from being tossed around as cheap labor, desperate for a job, prepared to lose a finger, a hand, and maybe a leg in the process of producing and distributing cargo of all types. We want to see workers' control. Workers who are capable, who are able to know, they know the job, they know how to work together. In South Africa, we have a huge separation between stevedoring workers and the state sector, which is actually managing the cranes. If we had workers' control, we'd sort that out. We'd have better communication systems. We'd know how to work like the ILWU workers in San Francisco and Oakland. They run the show themselves. I've been there with them. And you can see when they've been asked to remove something like 150 containers. They work it out themselves, how it's done. We've got 12.5 million people unemployed.
Yes.
Why should we tolerate this? Why should we then cut down on the workers who are employed and pass over and turn that 12.5 million into 20 million unemployed? We are refusing to do that. We will boo those ministers off the platforms and tell them to footsack. That's what you shout at a dog which comes to bite at your heels. Footsack, get away. And that's what you are telling. We do not need them, but we then have a huge challenge. And this is something I'd like to throw out to all the comrades. We've got the challenge of international solidarity. Where one is standing up, support that. Rise up, stand up. That's what the workers are doing in South Africa and internationally, but we do need that support.
That was South African J.V. Dube, General Secretary of the Striking Revolutionary Transport Union of South Africa, and David Hemsworth, an organizer of Durban dock workers and one of the founders of COSATU. That was Sifo Hot Sticks by Shikisha. Now report on the fight against natural gas pipelines from Mitchell Cohn of WBI Pacifica Radio in New York.
Last August, 100 climate activists blockaded Senate Majority Leader Schumer's Manhattan office, demanding an end to the side deal Schumer had negotiated with Senator Manchin to buy the West Virginia senator's support for the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. 12 activists were handcuffed by the NYPD and arrested while conducting a peaceful sit-in at Schumer's office. A decade ago, mass protests rocked New York and eventually forced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo to ban hydrofracking, the cracking open of rocks underground using high-pressured water and extremely toxic chemicals to capture the methane gas released by that process. But despite the ban of hydrofracking in New York, the state's pipelines are nonetheless filled with methane gas, hydrofracked elsewhere, and distributed here. In fact, hundreds of protesters have been arrested over the last few years while blocking the construction of gas pipelines throughout the state. But when it comes to Ukraine, U.S. officials can barely conceal their glee over someone blowing up the key Nord Stream pipelines there. Those pipelines were set to transport fracked natural gas from Russia to the rest of Europe, needed to keep people in Germany from freezing this winter. I listened as Gigi Nissen addressed the crowd rallying in September at Borough Hall in downtown Brooklyn against the North Brooklyn Pipeline and asked if she'd explain the issues in more detail for Pacifica Radio.
My name's Gigi Nissen, and I am currently living in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, which is one out of the five different neighborhoods that the North Brooklyn Pipeline goes through. We have organized a whole bunch of community members from all of those five neighborhoods against this pipeline, which National Grid, the UK-based energy company, has been building for several years now. Really, we only started organizing about 3 years ago. That's when we first heard that they were building this pipeline and raising our gas bills to build it. But they had already started construction without telling any community members whatsoever about this project. We're organizing against this because it's a fracked gas pipeline. It's using fossil fuels, gas that's extracted through a really dangerous process in states like Pennsylvania, New Jersey, where they actually have legalized fracking, the drilling, the procedure. And it's so toxic and it's so dangerous that New York State banned fracking, but they still allow fracking infrastructure such as this pipeline to be built. So it's a weird, hypocritical loophole that big energy companies like National Grid can use to just exploit people and get as much profit as possible. And so today we had an action in front of Brooklyn Borough Hall to say, like, we are rejecting this pipeline because National Grid is making us, the ratepayers, pay to construct it. Meanwhile, the gas that's being put through the pipeline isn't even going to New Yorkers in those communities. So we're literally paying for something that, one, damages our climate, our health. It's built next to hospitals, daycares, schools, all of these things. It's a highly explosive gas. And also, we're never going to see the light of day and use it. So they're literally making us pay millions of dollars for something that is completely just terrible for us. The rally today was in support of people joining our gas bill strike, which is withholding $66 a portion of their National Grid bills. Pretty much everyone in Brooklyn pays National Grid, and people on Long Island, some people in Queens. So all people that pay National Grid to withhold $66 a month from their gas bill, because that's actually the exact amount that we're paying for the pipeline. National Grid has been trying to expand their storage capabilities at these two vaporizers at the head of the pipeline. And there are two hearings coming up that are specifically about that. And we want to make sure that people come to those hearings and speak out about it.
So what is a vaporizer?
Basically, at the head of the pipeline, there are these two giant tanks, storage tanks, that carry the liquefied natural gas, the LNG. And so the vaporizers are attached to the tanks, and they allow the gas to be used and stored. It'll allow the capacity for those tanks to be bigger and more efficient. So essentially, they'll be able to pump more gas faster and more frequently. And at the same time, harming the water systems, our air quality, all of these things. So the vaporizers are a really important component to the North Brooklyn pipeline struggle because they'd essentially allow more gas to be pumped through and used.
They argue they also increase the safety of the stored gas. It makes it more efficient, but it also makes it less unsafe.
Right. The whole project in itself is very unsafe, you know, and they've already completed phases like 1 through 4 of the pipeline. The movement has stopped phase 5, which is the area between these vaporizers and the upgraded pipeline sections. We don't need any of this infrastructure. So if they upgrade any point of it or every part of, whether that's on the pipeline or the storage facilities or any of that, it essentially legitimizes them being there and legitimizes the fact that they should be able to carry on these projects that the community never wanted or asked for.
So where are people supposed to get their gas for their stoves from? Does it all have to be fracked? Can you get gas that's not fracked?
For this specific pipeline, no one's going to see the light of day from any of that gas. So it's not even going to be for the communities that this pipeline's being put into. So even if people were, like, say, in support of using gas in their homes, this kind of is irrelevant because they're not even going to have it for this purpose. The North Brooklyn Pipeline Coalition is also working on, especially during the legislative session, 2 separate bills that would start to wean New York City off of gas and onto electricity. We're trying to pass this mandate that all new construction be hooked up to electricity, not gas. Because in the future, if we want to go towards a renewable energy future, like, buildings will not have to be, could not be hooked up to gas anyway. Like, they will have to be hooked up to electricity.
But as it stands now, electricity is totally polluting because they're not using solar, because they're not,
yeah,
right?
For sure.
They use these power plants all over the place.
Yeah, but I mean, there's an option to not, right? With gas, if you hook up to gas, you have to get it from gas. If you hook it up to electricity, there's an option to move towards renewable energy into the future. And without making that switch, then we're not even gonna be able to get there. Even if electricity is not right now completely created by renewable energy, at least it has the potential to be so, right? Gas has no potential. It's a fossil fuel through and through. We're looking towards the future because we know that we do have options like geothermal, like hydropower, like wind, like solar. You know, those are all technologies that we have, and they're getting more and more efficient every single day. The technology can really are on the trajectory to powering our future. We even have made suggestions to put geothermal and heat pumps in buildings that are connected to gas right now that could be converted. But it's all about making sure that we're thinking ahead. Right now, we have to stop this pipeline. Right? Like, that's a very now thing. And ahead, we have to move towards renewable energy. So let's make sure that people get off of gas onto electricity so we can actually make that a potential future.
So how many pipelines are there? They were planning to build one near Kennedy Airport under Jamaica Bay in the natural wildlife area. Mm-hmm. And that was going to destroy that whole area.
Yeah. Nationally, there are thousands of these pipelines. And there are different types of pipelines too. Like, this is a large capacity fracked gas pipeline. It's not the same as the pipelines that go to individual homes. A lot of people have heard about the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Line 3 pipeline in Minnesota, and then now the Line 5 pipeline that's being proposed there. There are just so many of them, and that's why it's so important that we have these localized fights and people are made aware of these issues. Here in New York, Con Edison, which is also an additional large energy monopoly. Basically, if you live in New York City, you're either paying Con Edison, National Grid, you're either paying one of the two. They're all building infrastructure, and a lot of it in primarily, you know, black and brown, low-income communities, and not telling anyone about it. And then those areas have high rates of asthma, they have high rates of cancer, they have high rates of infant mortality, and people wonder why. Well, it's because of this infrastructure that is poisonous that they're not telling anyone about. This one is the one that we're specifically focusing on, but, you know, we stand in solidarity with all of the other ones that are happening. We don't want it anywhere. We've seen that these companies are more likely to put it in places where they think that there's not going to be pushback, and that's especially in like black and brown communities. But like, we don't want any of this infrastructure anywhere because we want to transition to a renewable energy future. The fact of the matter is this project is in these communities, these black and brown low-income communities, but if it was anywhere else, we would want to stop it too.
Mitchell Cohen, WBAI Pacifica Radio, New York.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, because the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure creates fissures 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That well is fracked, yeah, totally fracked.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep it far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fissures are a mile below the groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the residents of Subway. That water's fracked. We're talking benzene.
What the f*** is going on with all this fracking going on? I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
This was My Water's on Fire Tonight by David Holmes, Andrew Bean, and Neil Becker. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. Last week, the European Parliament voted on a resolution calling for a massive increase in weapon shipments to Ukraine. Here is Irish member of European Parliament Claire Daly speaking against the resolution, which ultimately passed by a vote of 504-26 with 36 abstentions.
The war in Ukraine is quickly escalating into a wider horror. And from what I can see, practically nobody in this chamber is doing anything to prevent it. In fact, most people seem to get off on the fact that it's escalating. And at this precise moment, of course, as usual, the voices challenging the rush to war are attacked and silenced, smeared as traitors, cronies, Putin puppets, Kremlin stooges, Russian agents. Frankly, it's pathetic. And I don't make the comparison lightly, but the crudeness and cynicism of these slurs coming from mainstream EU parties might as well have been written by Hermann Göring, who infamously said that even though people never want war, they can be brought to war with threats and smears. He said, all you have to do, tell them they're being attacked, denounce the pacifists for lack of patriotism and exposing their country to danger. It works the same every way. Where he led, you are following. This House should be ashamed of this debate. Words are being twisted, meaning subverted, and the truth turned on its head. Opposing the horrible madness of war is not anti-European. It's not anti-Ukrainian. It's not pro-Russian. It's common sense. The working class of Europe have nothing to gain from this war and everything to lose. And I find it laughable that those calling for arms to Ukraine never call for arms for the people of Palestine or for the people of Yemen. Unlike you, I oppose all war. I want it stopped. I make no apology for that, and I'm not going to be scapegoated and labelled for it either.
That was Claire Daly, member of the European Parliament representing Ireland.
A war for gold, a war for money, and a war for souls. A war on terror, a war on drugs, a war on kindness, a war on hugs. A war on birds and a war on bees. They got a war on hippies trying to save the trees. A war with jets and a war with missiles. A war with high-seated government officials. Wall Street war on high finance. A war on people who just love to dance. A war on music, a war on speech. A war on teachers and the things they teach. A war for the last 500 years. War's just messing up the atmosphere. A war on Muslims, a war on Jews, a war on Christians and Hindus. A whole lot of people saying kill them all. They got a war on Mumia Abu-Jamal. The war on pop is a war that's fair, a war that's filling up the nation's jails. World War 1, 2, 3, and 4. Chemical weapons, biological war. Bush War 1 and Bush War 2. They got a war for me, they got a war for you.
We can't stop when the beat just drops. We can't stop with the rebel rock. We can't stop until we hit those highs.
That was They Got a War for You by Michael Franti. As part of a national week of action, more than 70 rallies are being held in the U.S. and around the world, sponsored by the United National Anti-War Coalition, to protest the growing U.S. and NATO war in Ukraine. On October the 15th, anti-war protesters rallied at the Oakland Federal Building to speak out against the U.S. proxy war with Russia and Ukraine and the tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons that the United States is pumping into the war and the growing threat of nuclear war.
We're going to start with Bob Spies, who represents the Mount Diablo Peace and Justice Center.
At this point, our country is behaving like crumbling empires often do, or always have. And our wealth is being diverted into a corrupt and bloated military establishment. Our wealth is going into maintaining over 800 foreign military bases to attempt to maintain our domination around the world. It's going into the mansions of countless military contractors who now line the beltway around Washington. And it's going into the horrific use of remote technology to kill people in a sanitized way around the world. And it's going into maintaining a perpetual state of war, series of wars. Usually those wars have been against opposition that doesn't really have the ability to fight back. But that's changing now that we're challenging and going up against Russia and China. And in the past, there was some recognition of the fact that attempting to provoke military conflict with a foreign power that has nuclear weapons was not a winning strategy. But that recognition seems to have been forgotten this century, and as a result, we're facing the most dangerous situation since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And actually more dangerous in some ways, because this time nobody realizes it's happening, or almost nobody. We have a younger generation that is rightly concerned about global warming, but they don't recognize that global warming doesn't stand a chance against nuclear winter. For the last thousands of years, empires have risen and fallen, and ours is following the pattern, and we're in the falling phase. And when empires fall, there have almost always been major military conflicts as they attempt to retain their power. That's happening again, except this time it's happening in a world with nuclear weapons, and that's a change. This time either we're going to do things differently or we're not going to have another chance. I just want to read real quickly a couple of sentences from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is set to begin its military drills in preparation for nuclear war. American B-52 bombers will be joined by advanced aircraft from other alliance members as they simulate a war of annihilation with Russia. The war games, dubbed Steadfast Noon, will begin Monday and run through the end of October. This is a very, very dangerous period.
Hello, friends. My name is Anna Saron-Skibek, and I'm with Women for Racial and Economic Equality. War is a symptom of a problem with deep roots, the capitalist system. It is an economic system that is based on endless growth and limitless expansion. It is this unsustainable system that keeps us constantly at war. Billions of dollars that could be spent on healthcare, schools, and infrastructure is being thrown away to the war machine. This has no benefit to the working class. We can never forget, war is not some isolated event. It's essential for the capitalist system to function. Right here at home, we see the effects of glorifying U.S.-led wars and the violence against our children in schools, and the violence against people of color by police, and the sexist and bigoted violence against women and the LGBT community. Homelessness, poverty, inequality, this is all that capitalism and war can offer the American working class. It's bigger than any of us alone can handle, but together I promise we can win. We can build a safer, more cooperative world for all people by taking a stand against these endless U.S.-led wars. We can do this by demanding the reallocation of funds from the deadly U.S. military budget to fund desperately needed social services like healthcare and education, and by uniting to demand an end to U.S.-led wars and sanctions around the globe.
Again, like I said, we're at the beginning of the anti-war movement, and we have in the Bay Area an incredibly active and politically conscious union, the ILWU, Local 10, International Longshore and Warehouse Union. They have taken a stand throughout the decades against racism, to support the teachers, and against war, and against the bombing of Gaza. There is not a union in history that has taken these progressive stands. And in 2008, they shut down the port against the war. We're hoping that we can look forward to many future collaborations as we move forward with this new anti-war movement. So I would like to introduce Jack from the ILWU Local 10. He is retired. He is also with the Labor Action Committee to free Mumia Abu-Jamal.
We're going to the Ukraine. The labor movement has the power to stop this war if we can refuse to handle the military cargo. So victory to the working class.
Let's give a very warm welcome to a lifelong Haitian activist representing the Haiti Action Committee, Pierre Laboisier.
And for your solidarity, for inviting me here to speak on behalf of the Haiti Action Committee and in the name of the Haitian people. There has been an uprising taking place all over Haiti. It's been going on for decades now, against 18 years of the United Nations U.S. occupation of Haiti. And that occupation is the continuing occupation that started in 1915. So Haiti has known over a century of U.S. dominance to steal the resources of Haiti, and that has triggered massive exodus of the people of Haiti, fleeing the hell that was created from the 1915 original invasion, going through the Duvalier years. Duvalier was a lackey of U.S. imperialism, and continuing to the present. People in Haiti recently have intensified their uprising, have intensified their resistance of U.S. imperialism, supported by the French, the Canadians, and other countries that are part of this imperialist venture in Haiti. And it's about the same thing as that brought Christopher Columbus to the land. It's a land, it's an operation of conquest, a war of genocide, to steal resources, to steal gold and other resources. Haiti has plenty of resources, mineral resources, petroleum, gold, copper, uranium, marble, iridium. Those are the things that are in the Haitian subsoil that they want to get. In addition to that, they also want to exploit Haitian workers to pay them $2 a day or $3 a day so that they can continue to undercut the wages of unionized workers, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. We are going to be in the streets. We are the Haiti Action Committee, and we want your support and your solidarity.
Those were speakers at an Oakland, California rally against the growing U.S. proxy war with Russia in Ukraine and the danger of nuclear war. For more information on rallies to be held this week of October 15th, visit the website of the United National Anti-War Coalition, unacpeace.org, unacpeace.org. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. This week's show was produced by Steve Zeltzer, Polina Vasilyev, Thomas O'Rourke, and Ann Garrison. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.